I arrived at the mansion of Mr. Reginald just at sundown. That's when the game was supposed to begin. I'd received an invitation in the mail for a night of party games with a huge cash prize for the winner. I was really struggling to pay off my student loans, so I couldn't say no. The door opened, and a tall, elderly man greeted me. He said his name was Mr. Reginald, and he ushered me inside. The two other players were already there, Harvey and Jackson. Harvey was about my age, early 20s, though he was much smaller than I was. Jackson was probably in his 30s, and he seemed quite out of shape. Right away, I knew I had a good chance of winning the prize. Reginald led us to a grand dining room where we sat at an elaborate table covered with all kinds of food. We ate and talked. The other players seemed a little nervous, which seemed a bit strange. This was just a fun game night, right? When we were done eating, Mr. Reginald rose from his chair and explained the rules. He had planned a series of challenges based on childhood games. After each challenge, a player would be eliminated until only one winner could claim the prize. He assured us that there were no tricks involved. I didn't quite believe him, though. There was something strange about his expression, like he was toying with us. Harvey and I exchanged glances. He was thinking the same thing I was. Jackson, meanwhile, kept his expression unreadable. I could tell he really wanted to win. Mr. Reginald led us into an adjoining room where he explained the first game. It was freeze tag. One player would be it, chasing the others around the mansion. If he catches someone, then they freeze in place. It's a game I used to play all the time back in elementary school. Mr. Reginald asked who would like to be it, and I immediately raised my hand. I figured that I had the best chance of catching the others. The man pulled out a small black box and he handed it to me. "Once you put this on," he said, "the timer starts. You have 15 minutes to freeze the others." Inside the box was a black glove covered in wires and metal plates. Must have been really expensive. I pulled out the glove and slid it onto my hand. The other players instantly ran out of the room. The glove felt normal at first, but after a few seconds it tightened around my wrist. I couldn't pull it off, and slowly my hand began to feel cold. I tested out the glove by touching the wall. Ice immediately formed on the wallpaper. Mr. Reginald had taken the idea of freeze tag very literally. "Go," Mr. Reginald told me. "The clock is ticking." I started down the hallway, walking slowly so that they couldn't hear my footsteps. I tried to listen for any kind of movement, but the mansion was deathly quiet. As I rounded the corner into another hallway, I started to speed up. My hand was throbbing from the cold now. It was getting colder every second I wore it. I pulled at the band around my wrist, but it was tighter than ever. This glove was not coming off. That's when I started to panic. I'd been wearing the glove for less than a minute, and I was already in terrible pain. If I kept it on for the whole 15 minutes, I was sure I'd get frostbite. My only choice was to find the other players and end the game fast. The hallway led into a wide library with thousands of books and a bunch of furniture. There were plenty of places to hide, so I assumed at least one of the other players was in here. It didn't take me long to find Jackson curled up under a desk. It would have been a good hiding spot, but now that I'd found him, he had no way to escape. He was trapped there, and all I had to do was touch him with the glove. "Don't," he begged. "Please." My hand was in so much pain now. I felt like my fingers were going to fall off. Deep down, I knew that if I touched him with the glove, something very bad would happen. This wasn't just a normal game, this was dangerous. But I couldn't bear the pain anymore. I had to touch him. I reached forward, and I pressed the glove against his cheek. He immediately screamed in pure agony. And when I pulled the glove away, ice crystals had formed on the side of his face. My hand, thankfully, was no longer in pain, It seemed that all the cold had transferred to Jackson. I thought he'd just have freezer burn on his face, but as I watched in horror, I saw that his skin was crumbling away in frozen chunks. Within seconds, he slumped forward, dead. His face was almost completely gone. My glove clicked once and fell off my hand. Mr. Reginald's voice came out of an unseen loudspeaker from the ceiling. "Time is up! Will the remaining players please return to the dining room?" I took one last look at poor Jackson and trudged back to the dining room. This game was not right. I needed to get out of there before I ended up like Jackson. When I got to the dining room, Harvey was waiting for me. "Did you catch the other guy?" he asked. "Yes," I said. "He's out of the game." That's all I said. I couldn't tell him that he was lying dead in the other room. Harvey looked at me suspiciously. He could tell that I was hiding something from him. Mr. Reginald joined us, a huge smile across his face. "It looked like there's just two left. Are you ready for round two?" I opened my mouth to say no, but before I could, Harvey shouted, "I'm ready!" "Good," Mr. Reginald answered, "because I've decided to raise the prize pot to $2 million. He nodded toward the door. "This is your last chance to leave now." I knew I should have left, but the idea of becoming a millionaire was something I couldn't refuse. Besides, I had one advantage over Harvey. I knew that the danger was real, and he didn't. Slowly, I nodded. Let's continue. Harvey and I sat at the grand dining room table, waiting for Mr. Reginald to tell us his next twisted game. I was racked with guilt for not telling Harvey that the other player had been killed. Deep down, I knew that I'd made a grave mistake for not leaving, but it was too late to back out now. Mr. Reginald stood at the head of the table, grinning at us both. "For our next game, we're going to play Capture the Flag." The rules seemed simple enough. We each had to hide a flag somewhere in the mansion. Once we were ready, we had 15 minutes to find the other's flag. If we returned it to Mr. Reginald before the timer stopped, we'd win $2 million. If we didn't, we were eliminated. I could only assume that the elimination would be just as deadly as the other round. "What if we both find the flags?" Harvey asked. "Then you both receive $1 million, Reginald explained. He pulled two flags out of his pocket. He handed the blue one to me and the red one to Harvey. "It's time to find your hiding places." And with that, he left the room. Harvey and I exchanged glances. He was about to say something, but I ran off before I could hear it. Because Harvey was shorter than me, I decided to hide his flag at the top of a tall wardrobe in the study. I could hear Harvey running around in the library, so I knew that's where his flag was. Mr. Reginald's voice came on the loudspeaker, telling us to return to the dining room immediately. I got there first, but Harvey was right behind me. He checked to see if Reginald was nearby and then whispered, "Tell me where yours is and I'll tell you where mine is." "The study," I told him. "The library," he said, "under a pile of maps." He paused. "Where exactly in the study?" Before I could answer, Mr. Reginald returned to the room. "Sharing secrets?" he asked. "No," we both said. "Good. You now have 15 minutes for your search. Clock starts now." I ran straight to the library and found his flag in no time at all. I could hear Harvey through the wall. It sounded like he was throwing stuff onto the floor in his desperate search. From the loudspeaker, Mr. Reginald shouted, "Once you have your flag, please return it to me." I had two choices. I could go straight to Mr. Reginald, or I could return to the study and help Harvey. I thought about this for a while, but in the end, I went back to our host. Harvey still had time to find the flag. He could make it. When I re-entered the dining room, Mr. Reginald grabbed the flag out of my hands and congratulated me on a job well done. Your competitor still has 5 minutes. I thought about helping him. I really did. But in the end, I just stood in silence next to Mr. Reginald as the clock slowly ran out. Mr. Reginald announced that time was up, and Harvey trudged back into the room empty-handed. He was glaring at me, so I looked away. "My apologies," Mr. Reginald told him, "but it looks like you have been eliminated." He pulled a lever on the wall, and a trapdoor opened up right under Harvey. 1 second he was there, and the next he was gone. The trapdoor slammed closed immediately after, so I never got to see what became of him. Smiling, Mr. Reginald reached out his hand. "Good job, sir." We shook hands. On one hand, I was proud of myself for winning both games, but on the other, I felt horrible. I knew that Harvey was going to be killed, and yet I didn't help him. "Right this way," the man said. "It's time to claim your reward. Unless..." He stopped, letting his word hang in the air. "Unless what?" "Unless you'd like me to bring in more challengers and start again. I can raise the prize amount."
"No!"
I shouted. "I'm done!"
"Are you sure?"
He said that he rarely met a competitor as bloodthirsty as me. He said I had a real talent. That just made me feel guiltier. "No, I'm done." He grabbed me by the shoulder and guided me to a door I hadn't noticed before. "Step inside. The money's waiting for you. All you have to do is take it and leave through the exit." He watched me as I pushed open the door and stepped inside. The door slammed shut behind me. In the center of the room was an envelope with the money check. Behind it was another door, this one with a neon exit sign. I never wanted to see Reginald again, so I grabbed the envelope and headed for the exit. It wouldn't open. The loudspeaker crackled again. "The exit will only open if you press the two buttons on the wall. Simple enough, right?" I saw one red button on the wall, but I didn't see the other one. I looked around the room and I couldn't find it. And then, finally, I saw a second red button on the opposite wall. I pressed them both, one at a time, but the door still wouldn't open. "You have to press them at the same time, sir," Mr. Reginald explained through the speaker. And then it took me a second to realize the weight of his words. It was physically impossible to press both buttons at once. The exit would only open if there were two people in the room. But since Harvey was gone, I was stuck here. I tried the other door, the one I'd entered, but that one wouldn't open either. I could hear Mr. Reginald laughing on the other side. I demanded that he let me leave. I screamed at him. I called him a liar and a psycho.
"I never lied," he said. "You won the money fair and square. Unfortunately, I never promised to let you escape."
I spent the next hour trying to figure out how to get out of that room, but it was useless. I couldn't press both buttons at once, and I couldn't pry open the door. So now I'm sitting here, holding more money than I can ever spend. I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, and I feel completely hopeless. Mr. Reginald was never going to let anyone get out of here alive. The other players died quickly, but I guess I'm going to just starve to death. There were 3 participants left in the competition: me, Tracy, and Marcia. I didn't know Marcia that well, but Tracy and I had developed somewhat of a friendship over the last few weeks. We helped each other survive the Simon Says Challenge without getting squashed by boulders. She wasn't the most physically able contestant, but she was great at figuring out clues and calming the other players down when things got tough. And now, after watching the other 47 contestants get eliminated in increasingly disturbing and morbid ways, the three of us were finally safe. The front man announced over the loudspeaker that we were supposed to meet at the round table to discuss how we would divide up the prize money. We sat across from each other at the circular table. It looked so much bigger now that there were only three of us left. We each had a glass of champagne and a small chalkboard in front of us. Even though the game wasn't officially over yet, this was the first time in weeks that I didn't feel scared or paranoid. The loudspeaker crackled, and the front man's voice congratulated us on a job well done. We'd survived all 12 challenges without getting hurt. He told us to clink our glasses and enjoy the victory. Tracy looked at me from across the table, silently asking if we really should drink the champagne. Since day one, this game had been filled with tricks. She didn't touch her glass, and neither did I. Marcia held hers up to her mouth, but she wasn't drinking either. "It's okay," the front man said. "This is the time to celebrate. Trust me, there are no more challenges. All that's left is a discussion about your winnings. But we can't start the discussion until you all drink." As always, his voice had a hint of anger. This whole time, we'd never actually seen the front man, but we knew he was always watching us. Eventually, Tracy shrugged and raised her glass. I did too. "To us," she said. All three of us took a sip. The champagne tasted completely normal. It was quite good, actually. Once we set down our glasses, the front man continued. "As a group, you've won $10 million. Congratulations. Now, you must decide if you want to split the money equally. If that is your choice, please write an equal sign on your chalkboard. Don't show the others. If, however, you want the money all for yourself, please write a plus sign." I looked at Tracy's face. She was smiling awkwardly. Marcia's face was pretty unreadable, though. The voice went on to explain that if all three of us wrote an equal sign, then the game is finished. But if even one of us chooses the plus sign, then we have to face our deadliest challenge yet, a challenge that will guarantee that only one of us survives. We sat in silence for a while, until Marcia finally said, "I'm choosing to end things now." "Me too," Tracy said. They both waited for me to respond. I really didn't want to go through another deadly challenge, and I was more than happy to split the winnings. But I didn't know if I trusted Marcia to tell us the truth. Marcia glared at me, as if my silence was proof that I was going to backstab them. "I'm with you guys," I said. "Let's share it." The voice told us to write our answers on the chalkboards and keep them hidden. As I'd promised, I wrote an equal sign, hoping that the others did the same. We lowered our boards to keep them hidden, and then the front man told us to reveal our boards. Tracy went first. She wrote an equal sign. I wasn't surprised. I went second, revealing that I too had written an equal sign. Then we had to wait for Marcia. Her face was still frustratingly blank. Slowly, she flipped over her board, revealing one more equal sign. I immediately squealed with excitement. No more games. No more danger. The three of us were going to walk out of here with $10 million to share. The middle of the round table opened up, revealing a platter of three gold medals with a circular container of shimmering liquid in their centers. They were very pretty. We each reached out and picked one. It was a lot heavier than I'd expected. Once all three of us had the medals around our necks, the door at the end of the room opened by itself. I couldn't see what was on the other side, but I could hear voices. It sounded like a live studio audience. "And now," the front man announced, "you may step through the door. Once you're on the other side, you will receive your prize. But do not close the door before everyone exits. It will lock behind you." We all stood up. After all this effort, all we had to do was walk into one last room. But when I looked at Marcia's blank expression, a dark thought occurred to me. What if she closed the door before Tracy and I made it through? Would that mean she'd keep all the money for herself and leave us with nothing? Would that mean we'd be trapped in the mansion forever? I couldn't let that happen. While they both walked slowly to the door, I rushed past them. I even pushed Marcia to the side. I ran through the door first. No matter what happened, I'd get my prize. But if I closed the door before they made it out, I'd get their prizes too. I knew we had just voted to share, but I couldn't stop myself. $10 million was a lot of money. So just as they reached the door, I grabbed the handle and pulled. Marcia tried to stop me, grabbing the metal that was hanging from my neck. She was able to rip it off me, but that didn't stop me from closing the door completely. They pounded on the other side, but there was nothing else they could do. I felt a little guilty, but I also felt proud of myself for using strategy to win the game at the last minute. I turned around, and for the first time, I saw VIPs watching me. Their faces were covered with masks. They were clapping and seemed thrilled to see me. Then the front man approached me.
"Congratulations, Pam. In one final surprise," the front man announced, "Pam has decided to take all the money for herself."
He pulled a cloth away from a small platform where a huge pile of gold coins was waiting for me. My heart raced, but I felt a little woozy, too.
"Unfortunately," he continued, "I forgot to mention that your celebratory champagne was laced with a fast-acting poison. If left untreated, you only have hours left to live." That's why I was feeling so woozy. That's why the stage felt like it was spinning under me.
"To be fair, I've given you the antidote in your winner's medal. Just break it open and drink the liquid and you'll be fine." I reached toward my neck, completely forgetting that I no longer had my medal. It was still on the other side of the door.
"Oh no," the front man said in fake surprise. "All this money is yours, but you only have hours left to enjoy it."
Then he walked over to the door and knocked. "Tracy, Marcia, you will go home empty-handed, but please remember to drink your antidote." So in the end, I won the competition, but my one selfish act was my death sentence.
My name is Charles. I've worked for the same company for 2 years, and in that time, I've climbed the ladder faster than anyone else. Why? Because I know how to play the game. Business isn't about talent or hard work. It's about power, knowing where to step, who to step on, and how to make sure they stay down. Take Terry, for example. She's been with the company for 8 years, busting her tail and racking up accolades. She's good, I'll admit that. But good isn't enough. She doesn't know how to maneuver, how to make people need her. She thinks talent alone will carry her. Poor thing. When I got promoted over her, I could see the resentment in her eyes. It was delicious. I knew she'd been gunning for the same position, but honestly, who would choose Terry? She's too meek, too careful. Meanwhile, I'm bold, decisive, and most importantly, I've got the bosses wrapped around my finger. The Florida conference was my masterpiece. I told the team we'd all be going, but when it came to Terry, I spun a story about limited accommodations. She bought it, as I knew she would. But then she surprised me. She pushed back, offering to stay at an Airbnb just to attend. That was bold for her. I'll give her credit for that. Fine, I thought. Let her come. It'll be easier to put her in her place when she's right under my thumb. I made sure to give her the wrong itinerary and let the resort staff know she was trouble. When she showed up, I could tell she felt out of place. Perfect. A little alienation would soften her up. But then, she had the gall to sit with Mr. Jenkins at breakfast, flashing her ideas and stealing his attention. That was a problem. Jenkins liked her. Too much. If I didn't act fast, she'd turn this whole thing around. That's when I decided to take matters into my own hands. "Terry," I said, "why don't you check out the sauna? It's great for relaxation." She hesitated, but I insisted, practically dragging her there. Once she was inside, I jammed the lock and cranked the heat. As I walked away, I couldn't help but chuckle. She'd be out of commission long enough for me to steal the spotlight and her precious Harding initiative. By noon, I was in the conference room, commanding attention like I always do. My presentation on the Harding initiative was flawless. I'd studied her notes, of course, and polished them into something truly exceptional. The clients were eating it up. Everything was going perfectly until the projector screen flickered to life. There it was. Security footage of me locking Terry in the sauna. The room gasped. Jenkins' face turned an alarming shade of purple. And then, like a phoenix rising from the ashes, Terry stormed in, dripping wet and red-faced, snatching the microphone from my hand. She finished the presentation, and the room erupted in applause. I won't lie, it was a setback. Jenkins ordered an investigation, and for a moment, it looked like I was finished. But I hadn't clawed my way to the top just to be taken down by someone like Terry. I had leverage. I knew things. Things about Jenkins, about the clients, about everyone in that room. When you're as observant as I am, you collect secrets like trophies. While Terry basked in her brief moment of triumph, I made my moves behind the scenes. I leaked just enough dirt on Jenkins to remind him who held the power. A discreet conversation with the clients turned their admiration for Terry into doubt. By the time the investigation wrapped up, the narrative had shifted. Terry wasn't a victim. She was an opportunist, desperate for attention and willing to sabotage the team. Jenkins called me into his office. "Charles," he said, "this whole situation has been a mess, but I've reviewed everything, and I think you handled it as best as you could under the circumstances. Let's put this behind us." Terry, on the other hand, was quietly transferred to a less visible position. I heard she left the company a few months later. As for me, I got a promotion. The Harding Initiative? It's now the Charles Initiative, and it's the crown jewel of my career. Terry thought she could beat me at my own game. But the thing about power is that it's not about being right, it's about being untouchable. And I'm untouchable.
I knew what was coming. Everyone in the car knew what was coming. And I had a sense that Andy, my 16-year-old younger brother, also knew, because he did not throw a tantrum the entire trip back from church. And Andy always threw a tantrum on our way back from church. Nothing troubled the stiff tranquility in the car, but for the occasional sighing that my father let out at unrhymed intervals. I was in trouble because I had kissed a boy in church. The car squealed when my father turned it into the street, and I felt my heart thump so furiously against my rib cage that I feared that if it beat any faster, there would be a gaping hole there in the stead. My mouth ran dry and parched, quicker by the second, as the car glided down the street to our own house. With the left swerve of his hand, Dad sharply cut the bend, and we were in the walkway. "Worthless child. Better dead than bringing us shame," Mother said in a desperate breath. "The soul that sins must die," my father said. And my blood ran cold. I felt turbulence brew in me so powerful that it made me shed a tear. I understood his words were no joke. He had done it before. He was revered in the neighborhood and had such powerful connections that had proven useful the last time. The last time it was my older brother. He was 19 just like me when it happened, but it still felt like a lifetime ago in my eyes. I recollected the details in broken pieces. He had been with a girl in church, and they had been caught in a compromising position. Father, Mother, Andy and I, and Tom had been in the car all the way home. Then, Father had said something of the sort. I went to my room on that occasion, and it was barely hours later that I heard Tom start to cry. He begged terribly in his crying. He begged for respite from Father's holy anger and Mother's righteous indifference. With each cry, I could sense his strength wane. I sniffed. "Come with me, Andy," my mother said, and pushed her side of the door open. Andy's side of the car clicked open, and Mother moved over to seize him. I stared downwards at the car latch on my side of the car, and it was still shut. I blanched in horror. "You must say your repentance. Your blood atones for the sins of your flesh," my father said, a stable tone that only betrayed anger. I suspected that he had said the same words to Tom before he handed him a sacrificial knife. The same knife which the people of the church he pastors over cut themselves with when they have been caught in sin or confession to sin, until he decrees their trespass forgiven by heaven. I had no desire to bleed. Tom had bled. He had slashed his flesh with the blade until he was leaking. But Father did not find forgiveness until Tom was gasping for breath. I sniffed back at the thought of such a strange consequence. No, I cried, and jumped out through the seat where Andy had sat. I ran after Mother into the house because it was the only sanctuary I could think of. I did not want to bear such an ugly ritual because I'd kissed a boy. I had heard girls my age kissing boys, and they did not have such violent marks of violent encounters to show for it. Mother appeared aghast when she saw me come from behind her, nudging her to the side as I rushed to my room. Father was on his heels behind me, carrying the knife. I wasn't thinking. I was simply living in horror, which I wanted to escape from. I found my phone on my bed, and I rushed to my room and picked it up. My father's yelling was loud from the door when I clicked on the emergency numbers. Mother soon joined in the frenzy, as passionate as he was, that I must bleed, if I should atone for my sins. I fumbled terribly from panic that I dialed the wrong numbers twice before I finally got it right. 911. My head struggled to interpret the commotion that my parents' footsteps were coming to my door with Andy beside them. I was not ready to hurt myself, not like Tom, who they had broken in their lust for righteousness. I remembered how Father had dispatched the semi-conscious Tom in a van, which was owned by one of his close friends. It was the last time I had seen Tom. He had simply laid a missing person report at the office, and the officers had been misdirected. When the soothing voice of a respondent came from over the phone, I was drawn into a brief silence that required calling to draw out of me. I started to speak into the phone. I told them my address in a quick, shallow breath and heard from the respondent that police officers were on their way. I threw the phone on the bed and started to think of an escape route from my family. "Open the door, child. Accept your fate as it is," my father said, slinking the knife down the edge of the door to draw me out. The noise of the steel blade against the wood made my stomach sink. "Wretched child, a shame to virtue. Open up and feel the pain of your sins," my mother said. Father's patience ran thin. He lifted the knife and stabbed it through the door. The wood creaked. I was breathless with fear. "I will have to do it myself, since you are too cowardly," my father said, slipping into a frenzy. My skin was numb. I was so afraid that I started to go blind when my vision blurred out from the sheer force of blood pumping into my head. My lips quivered and my limbs trembled. I watched from inside the room as Father broke down the door. Mother had words, and she praised his strength, riling his devoted rally for the Lord. He saw me. I saw him, but he looked nothing like my father. His eyes were heavy and red. He appeared manic. Mother also had become the crazed version of herself, all of the exertion on the door. Father gripped the hilt of the knife tighter. I heard the shrill cries of sirens in the distance, and I took it as cue for my escape. I turned to my room's window and jumped through the gap in a daze. I ran as quickly as my feet could carry me when I saw the cops and ran to them with Father and Mother behind me.
"Put your hands up,"
the cops said to me, and then to Mother and Father when they stopped in our driveway.
"Sarah?"
the cops called. I answered that it was me. They then turned to my parents. The knife fell out of my father's hand.
"You're both under arrest for attempted murder," the cops said to my parents.